And now, our feature presentation.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Florida Sound Archive Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Kaiser, and for today's episode, I've got a special guest with me and a special name for this episode, What Happened to Rabbi? And if you're watching the episode and you see the person on your screen, you might remember him from his days promoting shows and going to shows in South Florida. I have on Rabbi. Welcome on to the podcast.
Hey, what's up, Jeff? How you doing, man?
I am doing fantastic. Good. Great to have you on. You're doing the episode in Miami, is that right?
I am. I was actually planning on doing this from the Cameo Theater, and the Cameo is closed. So my good friends over at Miami Inc. let me post up at their shop. So big shout out to Ami, to Jose, and to the great folks over here at Miami Inc., Love Hate, the tattoo shop right here on South Beach. So, you know, I mean, they totally hooked me up. So really appreciate that.
Very cool. So when you noticed the Cameo was closed, didn't look like it was the Cameo you knew growing up, how'd that make you feel?
Well, you know what? It hasn't been the Cameo of my childhood for a long time, right? So, you know, the Cameo played a special role in not only in my life, but I think in most of the lives of my contemporaries who were raised in the scene. I believe the Cameo started doing shows in 85. It was right after Flynn's had closed down, Flynn's Ocean 71. And I started going to shows the summer of 86, which coincidentally was not at the Cameo. The Cameo was closed down that summer. But the Cameo was almost a character in our lives. You know, because everything happened at the Cameo. The shows happened at the Cameo. The friendships, the people you met and the friendships that were developed that still carry on to this day. I mean, Ami's one of them, you know, someone that I met at the Cameo and to this day, you know. So there was something very unique about the Cameo and just the relationships that were forged at that place. It wasn't just a concert venue. It was one of those places where it was, you would go and you would see all your friends. So much, it's weird because you always think about high school and the different relationships you had in high school. Well, in the 80s, if you were punk rock, you really weren't part of your high school, you know, because you listened to music they didn't listen to. You were into skating and, you know, surfing and just a lot of things that just though they weren't into. They were into trying to fit in and just being cool, you know, wearing the designer clothes and so forth. And we were not, you know, we had the funny haircuts and the piercings and all that stuff. So the Cameo was that one place. It was like a refuge, you know, someplace you can go and you could see all your friends. And it was friends from as far north as West Palm Beach to as far south as, you know, the Keys. And like I said, these were people you would see all the time at shows. And it was just, like I said, in a lot of ways, it was almost like its own character, the Cameo itself, you know?
Yeah. There was a lot of stuff going on in Miami at that time too. A lot of drugs. Wasn't the safest place for a 16-year-old to hang out. So did your parents know what you were up to at that age?
Oh, no way. You know, it's, my parents are cool, but you know, and cool is relative, right? So my mom really liked music. So she was like into like Herb Albert and Tijuana Brass and so much stuff. Now I look back and like, oh man, my mom was into like all this. Like back then it was like, you just said, mom, not listen to that. You get older, you're like, man, it's almost like you discovered for yourself. And a lot of the music we did discover for ourselves. But you know what? I was raised on Kiss and Alice Cooper. And I'm talking about like 7, 8 years old, you know, started listening to that stuff. And I think that's kind of where it starts, right? It was the makeup. It was the appeal. And then from there, you evolve into Led Zeppelin and the Doors and Jimi Hendrix and the Who, all the, you know, dinosaur rock or like the 60s stuff. And eventually you start getting into skating, And then next thing you know, it's the Circle Jerks and 7 Seconds and the Meat Man and Suicidal and Black Flag. And next thing you know, you're at a show. So growing up watching some of the older guys in the neighborhood going to see Black Flag with Painted Willie and Gone. And they're like, come on, come with us. They were taking the bus. And I was 15 years old, you know. I probably had a hint of the tism, you know. I just was not ready for this. But, you know, skating, the funny haircuts, you know, I had a mohawk at the time. And come that June, I had turned 16, and I went to my first show. It was Charge GBH with Agnostic Front. It was the Brotherhood Tour. And it was at the Lincoln Theater, which is right down the street from the Cameo. It's like right on Lincoln Road. So Hellwitch was the opening band. And you could sit in the front row and kick your feet up on the stage, you know? By the time Agnostic Front got through their first song, the first three rows of seats were tore out. And it was stage diving, slam dancing. It was just absolutely wild. I think one of the things that struck me the most about that was how big the scene was. You know, it's one of the first times I actually really ventured out of my neighborhood. And, you know, you grow up with your friends and there's like maybe 10, 12, 15 of you as part of the crew, right? You're skating, you're you know, listening to music, you know, you got the local ramp. And suddenly you go there and there's hundreds of people that are also into the same music, into the same culture. And you almost have this spiritual kinship with them. Like, I went to go see Gorilla Biscuits, and it was great. I got to be 17 again for a little bit. But you didn't feel the same level of fear that you did going to the Cameo or even, like, my first shows where you had skinheads. You had a lot of violence. You know, South Florida is very, very known, was known very much for their violence. And that was all throughout the 80s and into the 90s. It was a lot of violence. I've seen friends get stabbed. I've had friends shot right in front of me. And I don't know if it was just because South Florida at that time, this was during the cocaine cowboy days. And it was Scarface. Scarface was filmed here on South Beach. That's what South Beach was. It wasn't what South Beach is today. It was dark. It was scary. It was dangerous. It was fun. It was crazy. You know, it's because the Cameo was out here on South Beach. So that was what drew us to this place. It was everything that drew us. Because if the Cameo wasn't on South Beach, we would never have come to South Beach. But because the Cameo was here, it's what drew us all here. Now, I mentioned earlier about the Lincoln Theater. Saw my first three shows there, and it was the first show, GBH, with Agnostic Front. The next show I saw was Descendants. It was Die Kreuzen. Die Kreuzen was the headlining band, but it was Die Kreuzen, Descendants, and Dag Nasty. But Die Kreuzen comes on, they're like, and everyone's yelling at them to play faster. They're kind of slow, sluggish. And they're like, we'll play how we want to play. And like 800 kids walked out of their concert. Like two songs in, everyone just left.
Did you know who was bringing these bands down to South Florida at that time?
At the time, it was Richard Shelter. I know Bob Slade also did a lot of stuff around that time as well. So I would say it was just between those two. They were really the main promoters here at this time. And both of them I have so much respect for. Both Bob Slade and Richard Shelter did is they did a lot of scene building. You know, if it wasn't for Richard Shelter, there'd be no scene down here. There would have been, listen, you know where Miami is in regards to the rest of the country. You're 4.5 hours away from Tampa, 4 hours away from Orlando. For a band to have to come all the way down here to play and then leave, it wasn't going to happen unless you had Richard Shelter and Bob Slade. Bob Slade did a great job building the scene down here. You know, he had a zine, Tropical Depression. He had Off the Beaten Path, his radio show on WLRN. And I remember during that time specifically, just being up. It was, I believe it was Monday nights at 12 to 2, just being up, you know, a school night, right? Just listen to the radio, you know, under the covers, you know. And he would play, like, I'm pretty sure he brought the Descendants Dag Nasty Showdown because he was playing Can I Say in rotation. I think the Descendants Enjoy had just come out, so it was playing Enjoy, you know, right, like just in rotation. So when you got to the show, you already knew all the songs and everything.
Were there any Florida bands you discovered from Bob Slade show?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, it's generational, right? So at that time, the big bands were Amazing Grace and the Drills. Those were like the two big bands down here. You know, it's generational, and it's also very reflective of the stuff that's happening, because regions are usually influenced by exposure. So the bands that would come through would influence the bands. You know what? I could be absolutely honest with you. I've seen Amazing Grace and the Drills many times. In fact, that Dag Nasty Descendants, Dykeuts, and the Drills opened up, but I couldn't really tell you a whole lot about either of those bands. You had Silent Rage. That was another band. And those are South Florida bands. You also had Disorderly Conduct up the coast. I believe they were north of Jupiter.
Melbourne.
I think Daytona. Melbourne. You had Sugar. You had so many great bands. I don't know if you ever heard The Chosen before. The Chosen, they were from Palm Beach or possibly Jupiter. Amazing, amazing band. But that's what happened. A lot of those bands never really got beyond, you know, just that local status. And playing the Cameo was every local band's dream, right? So there were bands that came up that became part of my generation, including Quit, Load, and Powerhouse, and Beyond Reason. And, you know, we'll get into those in just a little bit. The Believers, and they were all friends of ours. So eventually, as the scene evolved, bands like Amazing Grace and the Drills kind of faded out. And then you had all the backyard parties with bands like Foie and, Rugged Edge was part of that. Rugged Edge was more of a Fort Lauderdale skinhead band, you know. But once again, we were all friends. It was all like one giant scene. It was, you know, I spent just as much time in Fort Lauderdale and Coral Springs as I did in Kendall and in Homestead with, you know, with all these shows and so forth. So, or you know, just catching different bands and so forth. And to me, it's the local bands were the kids that really built the scene, right? Because especially if they were still in high school, all the kids that would come out to see them. And that really helped me when I started doing shows, you know, because I would usually use the bands that came out and supported. They were basically the kids that came to the shows. Those were the bands that would hook up when, you know, as opening bands for the shows. So it really worked out well. Not sure which show was first, but it was either Bad Brains and Dr. No or 7 Seconds with Verbal Assault. Four absolutely amazing bands, two incredible shows. That's the first time I ever saw Bad Brains. And I remember sitting in the balcony, you know, the Cameo had a balcony, and just sitting in the balcony watching the Bad Brains get high. And they're Rastas. I mean, this is the Bad Brains in 86.
Right.
Okay. All these bands, this was Verbal Assault blew me away, you know, on towards 7 Seconds. And 7 Seconds, that's one of the bands I've been into for like almost the longest. And man, like, you know, this is Walk Together, Rock Together. This is, you know what I mean? It's yeah, just so, like I said, I got to see both these bands a number of times after, but something about the first time, right? You know, right. The Bad Brains would come down again. That was probably September. The Bad Brains would come down again in February.
Was that and the first time you saw them with, did the Drills open up?
You know what? I don't remember. I don't remember who opened up. I remember Dr. No, because I love Dr. No, you know, and that was really great. And but the next time they came through Toxic Reasons, and it was February, and they went from this is Eye Against Eye had come out, So I think Eigenside just came out when I saw them the first time. The second time they came through, there's probably 1,500 people at the Cameo. And it was just absolute mayhem. But once again, this is the Bad Brains, really, in my opinion, at the very pinnacle of who they are, of who they were. You know, they're probably the biggest band at that time, definitely in punk rock and punk rock hardcore scene. But they were starting to get a lot of mainstream attention at this point. And to me, I think 87 was the best year of the Cameo as far as like that iconic year. I mentioned earlier about, you know, the Dead Kennedys and then Circle Jerks and Circle Jerks with Descendants and Suicidal and Black Flag all within six weeks of each other. You had one of my favorite shows of all time. It's 7 Seconds with Dag Nasty and Youth of Today. And this is the first time Youth of Today came through. And no one knew who they were. Okay. Evan Umbar, he knew who they were. Okay. Because he knew the New York scene and everything. And he was telling everyone, hey, you need to go check these guys out. It was the Can't Close Your Eyes, Can't Close My Eyes EP. They were selling it out of the van. They got added to the bill. Justice League was supposed to open. Justice League canceled out. And it was Houston Today. They end up getting stuck down here. Their van breaks down. They're staying with the Bad Rep Skins up in Fort Lauderdale. And they end up playing Skate Night up in West Palm Beach. And it was in Lake Worth. It was a skating rink that they did a skate night there, and suddenly Youth of Today is playing there.
Were there other Florida bands playing that too?
Not that show. I think it was Youth Today. I'm not sure, but you know, the Believers were up there and we were hanging out with them. You know, this is really where you kind of started to see the scene turn away from bands like Amazing Grace and the Drills, and now it started turning more towards bands like Flaw, Powerhouse. Beyond Reason was still a couple of years out, but Quit and Powerhouse were probably the two big bands down here at that time, local bands. I lived in a 6-bedroom house in downtown Miami. Bands would come through, they'd stay there. Green Day stayed at that house one tour, and Addison lived there. So, like I said, it was great. Like Brian Elliott from Timescape Zero, he lived there as well. So I could always tell who was at home by who was playing guitar. Okay. Addison was playing more of the melodic power pop stuff, Jawbreaker, Green Day, and Brian was playing more of the chunky metal, you know? So they were friends of ours. You know, I grew up with Tim and Ivan, very, very close friends with those guys. Even on the demo, a friend I went to elementary school, Mario Colangelo, he played with them. And like I said, it was just friends and just seeing them play. And that was the result of Youth of Today. Youth Today brought Straight Edge down here. And it was the ideology, of course, but more the fashion, the floor punch, the different styles of dance was introduced to South Florida. And all of that came from that 7-second show. I think, to me, you saw a shift in the scene from punk rock into more of the hardcore stuff. Bands like the Cro-Mags. The Cro-Mags came down in 87, but it was Harley's Cro-Mags. This is after John Joseph had left the band. It just so much of the scene changed from that point on suddenly. And it was a cultural change too, because you had the Believers demo had come out a little bit after that. The Powerhouse demo came out after that. And everyone was into writing letters to people around the country. So I know Ray from Youth Today, Ray Capo, he had correspondence. Walter had correspondence with people. It was a lot of tape exchanges and Revelation Records, you know, and the Sick of It All 7-inch had just come out, and the Gorilla Biscuits 7-inch, and this, you know, and all the record collecting really started down here in the scene. Whereas before, and not to take anything away from the David Bowie and the Iggy Pop and the punk rock of the scene, but hardcore started really taking off from there. And I know hardcore New York, You know, the Chromex probably go into 85, 84. A lot of that sound had already started. But now, and you can listen to the Misfits. Misfits are hardcore for sure. But you listen to Earth AD, where it's almost metal, right? And I think that's 83. So SSD had already moved into more of a metal direction. And you kind of saw just the music just got a lot heavier and a lot harder, especially stuff coming out of the Northeast. Both New York and Boston, Slapshot. And once again, the whole straight edge thing, you know, with the whole New York youth crew, yeah. All the Boston bands, you know, because Minor Threat was long gone at this point.
Sure.
And if my hardcore history doesn't fail me, you didn't really have a straight edge movement after Minor Threat in the DC area. Yeah, you had bands like Soulside and Beefeater. And Rites of Spring and amazing bands, all of them, but no one really, and whether they were straight edge or vegan or vegetarian, and they kept the ethos of it. Ethos, if I spoke English.
What did you think of that though when that came this when that landed in South Florida? What was your opinion of that at that time?
I was smoking weed a lot. I was smoking weed a lot back then, like daily at this point. And it was regardless of that, because, you know, as far as I know, 7 Seconds, those guys were straight, right? Minor Threat. Like, we listened to the music regardless of whether we believed it or followed the tenets of it. And I'm not going to call anyone out, but... You know, I was really good friends with a lot of these bands, right? Even the straight edge ones. So I'll just leave it at that.
Right. Fair enough. Were you ever compelled, because you're seeing all these people come down, you're seeing all these shows, like, did you play anything at that time? Were you ever compelled to pick up an instrument and play yourself at that point?
No, you know what? It was one of those things where I would have loved to have. And I think that, I don't know. You know, it's something, some people just do it and some people don't. You know, I have no problem speaking publicly now. And I find it somewhat romantic to be able to go back. And because you when you play in a band and you tour, you create certain memories, right? So you have a lot of different experiences. Like, I did shows and I've got to go on the road with bands, and I've got to see other bands around the country. Because I did shows down here, it became something that I really enjoyed doing. I don't know if it's a regret or not, because I guess it would have been cool if I would have done it, but since I didn't, then, you know, it's not something I can really go, like, look back. It's not like I don't have regrets that I didn't do it, you know, and I've got a lot of thoughts too on some of the folks that did do it, you know, because you have a very small window, right? You have a very small window to take it from this level to this level, to go from a local band to a national band to a our bills are paid band, you know? And a lot of people don't ever get that far, you know, professional musician. I think Addison from Quit became a professional musician. Juan Montoya was actually at one point doing this on a professional level. Jason Letterman, you know, he did this on a professional level. I think probably the most successful band to ever come out of the area was Cynic, a technical death metal band that went on to become prog metal. And probably good friends, number one, and just amazing people and just amazing musicians, like legit amazing musicians. And I think that that's somewhat more the exceptions than the rules. You know, I'm sure there's a lot, there's a few others sure. that became, you know, but I mean, I'm like a band like The Chosen. They were a great band. They really never made it beyond opening up for national acts on a local level. You know, you take a band like Radon out of Gainesville. I don't know if you've ever listened to them, but they are absolutely amazing. You know, the song structure, the ear candy, like, how could you not like a band like Radon, right? And they also had no idea. Did they ever really get to that level, you know?
Sure. Did you ever see Chocolate Grasshopper that predated Radon
back in the day? Oh, of course, yeah.
What are your memories of seeing them?
I saw them at the Cameo, of all places, you know? And it was like a local show that they played. But, you know, and there was another band out of Gainesville called the Doldrums. That was another really, really solid band. I got to see them at the Cameo. They opened up for DI and Doggy Style. I thought they were so much better than Doggy Style, but that's just personal, you know?
Were you only seeing these bands when they came down south, or did you ever find yourself going up and traveling a bit throughout the state?
I did, but I think that was a little bit later on. You know, I missed the Damned at the Cameo because, and it's funny, I was at the show and Foi was on their way to Melbourne to open up for 7 Seconds. So I just hopped up in the van with them. And I kind of regretted it because it was the final tour of the Damned. Not really, right? I think that was like 88. But I think the Jenner Torturers opened up. So I've seen the Jenner Torturers in Orlando, Adventures in Immortality in Orlando. Bloodlet. I've seen Bloodlet play a house in Gainesville. And Bloodlet, they're definitely top 10 of my favorite Florida bands.
What was that show like, seeing them in Gainesville?
Oh, it was a house party. It was great. it was a lot of fun. You know, it's like I said, I've seen a lot of cool things around the country. Like around the state. I've seen Awake. I brought Awake down. I knew those guys really well. I saw them up in Tampa. I saw the People's Court, another Tampa band, play. I think it was Don who played in Awake, did not play in Don's Ex-Girlfriend, but the band was named after him. And they were a really cool band out of Gainesville. Gainesville was one of those places, like, and I think it really hurt a lot of the local bands because some kids would go to school in Gainesville, right? So you'd break up the band here and you'd start a new band up there. And obviously you had Hot Water Music and Less Than Jake, you know, two very strong, well-known, well-toured bands. Addison eventually moved to Gainesville. I think that's what it was. You know, it's like a lot of local bands. It's like Russell moved away. So he left quit. He moved away. Cynic, after high school, they committed themselves to the band. And you had Paul and Sean, who were just like I said, just amazing musicians. And they were able to really just create a living out of this. And they actually did the Death tour. And then Chuck from Death asked them to do the Human album. And if you ever have a chance to listen to that, that's well worth a listen. Actually, there is you can find it on YouTube. There is a recording of just the bass and the drums from the Death Human album. And if you ever had any doubts, listen to that album and it'll erase all doubts about who Sean Reinhart was and what he could do. Like, God rest his soul, and sorry that he passed. He's one of my, he's that dude. I could just listen to Sean just play drums and I would just be happy. I mean, he's just so interesting. And I mean, I've spent so many days or so many evenings at their warehouse listening to those dudes play. And it was just, to me, it was just one of those things that you took for granted, because when you're 17, you're 18, you think you're going to be 17, 18 forever. And you don't understand. I really wish we knew that those days were just fleeting. You know, another thing that happened in 87 was Metal Nights at the Cameo. It was on Thursday nights, and they bring down bands like At War, Rigor Mortis, and just like all these like metal bands like Death and Morbid Angel. And we would go, like a handful of us, and we would sneak in. We knew security, so I don't even think it was like even considered sneaking in. So we would go and we'd catch all these metal acts. And that's when I first saw Cynic. And I thought Cynic was a national act by their sound, by the way they conducted themselves. Just everything about them was just like, wow. So Metal Nights at the Cameo. And there'd be like 15, listen, honestly, there'd be 50 people to see Depp play. So it was almost like a private show of these just amazing bands. And, you know, as a kid, we didn't just listen to hardcore. We didn't just listen to punk rock. We listened to Slayer. We listened to The Smiths. We listened to The Cure. You know, we listened to Public Enemy. We listened to Boogie Down Productions. To me, it was all underground music. So we were so diverse in our tastes, and it really opened up so many avenues for me on a personal level.
Do you think that a lot of the diversity of music that you were getting into, right? The hardcore, the punk, the metal, the more indie college rock kind of stuff, the hip hop. How much of that do you think went into your wanting to promote shows down in South Florida?
Like I said, I grew up in the scene down here, and the Cameo eventually stopped doing shows. I understand it more now than I did then, because I was just a fool in the crowd, right? But we get to 1990, and at this point, the Cameo is a done deal. Some friends of ours opened up a club on Alton Road called the Thrash Can, and they were more into metal than hardcore. It was Barry, it was Danny, it was Bobby Radical, and they wanted to bring down different acts and so forth. So they were going to bring down Gorilla Biscuits, and Gorilla Biscuits canceled. So at this time, I was starting to dip my foot in the water, and I wanted to actually start a record label. So the very first show I did was a local show, and it was Powerhouse, Foi, Quit, Cynic, and the Believers. And the record label never happened. But we did that show, and it was tremendous. It was a huge turnout. It was all local bands, right? There was nothing really I did. But the owners of the club approached me and was like, saying, hey, would you like to book concerts here? And I didn't really know anything about booking concerts, and I didn't really have enough sense to say no. So the very first show I did was I reached out to Walter from Gorilla Biscuits, because I was like, hey, listen, I know you guys canceled. You guys want to come back down and reschedule? Well, he's like, well, they broke up, but can my other band come down? Quicksand. And I think the 7-Inch had just come out. And I was like, yeah, let's do that. So it was Quicksand, this band Bazooka Joe from South Carolina, who just happened to be passing through. They were more punk rock. Awake was on that bill, and I think Beyond Reason. Jason Letterman, Brian Elliott from Timescape. It was their band that opened up, and it was great.
How important was it for you to make sure you had Florida bands opening up for some of these bands that were you bringing in from out of town?
Oh, 100%, because, like I said, these are friends of mine. And I think that my part of my scene building was including local bands on all the shows I did, because I understood the draw of the local bands. And once again, it was also my way to give back to my friends, because for them, most of them never had a chance to play the Cameo. The scene has always been generational. Like when I got into the scene in 86, there was an older generation that had been there in 85 and another generation that had been there since 84. And then, you know, eventually 87 would be my first show, and my first show in 1989, and now my first show in 1990. I talked to a friend of mine. He said his first show was Sam I Am. And I saw him at Gorilla Biscuits. He's like, man, I'll never, never forget you or thank you enough for bringing down Sam I Am. They were my favorite band. That was my first show. And that made me feel really good, because to me, I remember how it felt my first show. And here it was me bringing down a lot of these bands, and it became their first show. So I started doing shows in 1990 at the Thrash Can. I think that show was the local show was August. Quicksand came down in September. And then there was this guy, Fat Harry, out of Orlando. And what Fat Harry would do was he knew booking agents around the country, and they would contact him, and he would book dates with different venues around the state. Jim Hayward was one of them. Jim Hayward was up in the Palm Beach territory, And myself, I was down here in Miami. He started working with me doing shows, and he was skimming off the top. Okay. So basically, if a band wanted $500, he'd sell it to me for $800. Looking back now, I see how unethical that was, right? Because I didn't know any better. You know, when I talked to Walter the first time before I brought Quicksand down, he was like, "Hey, are you able to get us other dates in Florida? Because I can't come down, you know, New York to Miami and then back to New York." So I reached out to this kid, Richie, who lived in Tampa. He was with the Awake Boys. He knew all those guys. So we hooked up, and he was doing shows out there. And then there was John White. John White, I love John White. He was up in Melbourne. He was from Washington State. He did a radio show in Melbourne. I love John White. John White, do you know John? Did you ever meet John?
I have never met John, but I have heard his name brought up before from other people on the podcast.
He is such a salt of the earth dude, such a solid dude. And, you know, so many times, like, we created a really good connection where, like I said, every time a band would come through, we would do that circuit right there. And it made sense, right? Melbourne, Miami, Tampa, or Tampa, Miami, Melbourne, because you had to kind of keep it going, right? So, yeah, I'm sorry. I just thought of a bunch of great, great memories with John. You know, I remember one time going up to hang out with John, and then it was Jawbox, and something happened. I was supposed to bring Jawbox down, and it just canceled, and I just really had no control over it. Maybe that's kind of where the drugs came in. The drugs really were a problem. I didn't know it then as much as I know it now. I've been sober since 96. Okay. I'm talking about no drinking, no smoking. I don't even cuss. You know, they ended up playing Melbourne with Corrosion of Conformity. And I heard Kim from Jawbox talking about the stoner in Miami who messed up their show. And she didn't realize I was there because I was that stoner in Miami that messed up their show. So I guess I could have made it work, but whatever. But I remember going with John to go see Helmet and Jawbox in Orlando, and they played a pizza shop. Okay. Once again, that was the magic of hardcore as a kid coming up. You got to see so many great bands play small venues.
Did you at all know Jim Faherty, who was also promoting shows up in Central Florida?
You know what? I've never met him, but I've heard his name. I've heard his name a number of times, you know. But you know what? It's a circuit, right? It's a circuit. It's you know, you just make connections. The Tampa connection fell away when Richie went to college, you know. So suddenly it's kind of like a little void there. But my first 6 months of doing shows brought down Agnostic Front. This is when Roger just got out of prison. They were a different type of New York hardcore than the youth crew. They're all friends, but the crowd they drew, like Agnostic Front, Biohazard, the Cro-Mags, they bring more the skinheads. Whereas Youth Today, Gorilla Biscuits, Bold, Quicksand, Burn, they brought more of the hardcore kids. So just a little bit different. And the crowds were different because, like I said earlier, the Cameo is very violent. Lots of fights. You know, I remember seeing Blast at the Cameo, and they couldn't get through a single song without a major fight breaking out. I remember the Vandals coming through and playing the Cameo, and a bunch of white power skinheads came down from Central Florida somewhere, and they had the swastikas, and, you know, just they had it covered up until they didn't. And then once they didn't, it was on. You know, so the fight started in the lobby of the Cameo, went down the aisle, and then across the dance floor and right out the side door. Okay, it was just brutal. Yeah, let me show you. I'll share with you this really quick. Like, I was privileged to see SNFU, and one of my favorite bands. I had a chance to see them with the Accused the first time they came through, and then the next time they came through. No, that was the second time. The first time, I don't remember who the opening band was, but the Accused were amazing. And I got to bring them down, so I'm really happy about that. And I'll get into that. I got so much I got to get into. But some friends of ours, I mentioned trading tapes and all the letters across the country and so forth. Tim Price was very good friends. Tim was really good at this. Tim from Powerhouse, he was really, really good at just writing letters. And, you know, one of his first girlfriends was this girl, Julie. She was from Washington State. And all the kids from Washington State, Undertow, Mean Season, you know, all those bands. Oh, Mean Season was from California. But just we created this friendship, right? So Brotherhood comes down, okay? And Brotherhood gets hooked up on this tour with SNFU and The Accused, okay? And Brotherhood's opening up, and they have these shirts that say F racism, no tolerance for ignorance, right? So that's their shirts, and they're all bold about this. So we travel up with them to Orlando, and Orlando had a Nazi skinhead problem, big time. This is 1988, okay? So we show up, and they're all wearing matching shirts with the rebel flag crossed with the American flag, and they're marching to the show. And it's at the Beecham Theater. And the Beecham Theater really did remind me of the Cameo. It was one of those converted movie theaters. And evidently, all the Orlando skinheads were going to fight all the Tampa skinheads were coming in for the show. Okay, so this was a Nazi skinhead convention. And I'm sitting there just walking around the crowd, and you see these huge dudes. Like, I'm 6'4", okay? I'm 220. These dudes must have been 6'4", 250, bulk, muscle. These were old-time Nazi skinheads, huge, like Iron Eagles on their backs, swastikas, like full-blown. What I had never seen anything like this in my life. It was up close and personal. So I forget the band that was opening up, and it'll probably come to me like tomorrow night. I'll be in bed. Like, that's who it was. But the first band opens up, and they circle dance out there. Okay. That was something they didn't do in South Florida. South Florida was just basically just waves of people just running into each other. It was total chaos. It was fun, but it was chaos. They circle dance up there. And I watched this dude push the skinhead down and kick him to sleep. So his friends pull him out, and he's in the lobby, and paramedics are checking him out, and all his friends are around like, okay, let's go get them. So this huge fight breaks out on the floor, on the dance floor. It's all Nazi skinheads versus Nazi skinheads, okay? Thankfully, I'm with the band, so I hop up on stage. So I'm watching this with Tim Price. Ivan from Powerhouse is there. I think Evan from Foix. All the guys from Brotherhood are out there, you know, and we're watching this violence, and the cops come storming in. And, you know, we didn't have cell phones back there or anything, because I would have loved to have caught this. The cops kick all these white power skinheads out, and they all march out Zig Heiling in uniform, in uniform. And it's one of those moments I really would have wish I would have caught on camera. So after that, the show was great. You know, Ron from Brotherhood came out and said, you know, he might not have been able to come out on stage. They did not put out their merchandise until after that incident happened. Okay. So, and needless to say, The Accused and SNFU were just over the top, crazy, amazing. It was just a lot of fun. It was just a lot of fun. Another time, the first time I saw Fugazi was also in Orlando. And it was really tense, and I got to speak to Ian McKay about this incident in detail. This is the way I experienced it. I'm on the floor. A lot of us came up from Miami to see the show, and we understood that Miami really there was a lot of animosity in the different scenes around the state, and it wasn't really on the bands were cool. It was the crowds, right? So you had all these Nazi skinheads up in Orlando, and they weren't all skinheads. They looked regular, like regular dudes. So Fugazi starts, and you can feel like a real big tension in the air. And Ian McKay starts working this tension, right? So they're a couple of songs in, and, you know, there's a little bit of, you know, scuffle breaks out and so forth, and Ian stops the show. And, you know, starts lecturing the crowd about, hey, we're not going to have this. And he gets one of the mic. He's like, hey, so a lot of people said that Orlando was tough. And everyone's like, yeah. He's like, yeah, and he said, you know, people last night were saying that maybe we shouldn't even play Orlando. They played Gainesville the night before. Maybe we shouldn't even play Orlando. And suddenly everyone starts zig-heiling. Like, there must have been 1,000 kids zig-heiling Ian McKay. And he's like, oh, okay, so you guys are into that too, huh? And he's like, let's leave our politics at the door and just have fun. Song number one, which is off the EP. And just such an amazing show. Just such an amazing, amazing show. But talking to Ian, he remembers that very vividly. It was a really strange time, but West Palm Beach had a white power problem in the late 80s, early 90s. You know, and I know the Believers, they had to deal with that, do the Tampa show. But afterwards, they played Melbourne. And then I realized that we were the problem. Because the violence that we had in South Florida, we brought to a scene like Melbourne. And there was nothing there to keep it in check the way it was in Tampa with the white power skinheads.
During this period, right, the racism that you've been talking about and some of these memories of some of the bands that were bringing some of those people to the shows, your moniker that you were either given or you came up with, Rabbi, that obviously may not fly with every person who might be coming to a show like that. So talk about the origins of that moniker. Where does it come from?
It was just a skate thing. You know, I was a skater. I had a mohawk. And my friend Wesley, you know, he was Chinese and we started calling him Tokyo. Well, Tokyo's in Japan, like whatever. So he's like, he started calling me Rabbi. And then, you know, we used to skate over at the Island Ramp. It was Jamie's ramp. It was a half pipe behind Island Water Sports in North Miami Beach. Well, you had other kids from, you know, that's where I met Ivan from Powerhouse. But this is before he was in Powerhouse. And all the South Beach kids, you know, South Beach Jeff and all these friends. And then you had the Hialeah kids like Donnie, Cuban Donnie and Eric. And now we're all skating together. And Wesley and my friend Dan, they started introducing me as Rabbi. And they loved it. Now I start going to shows. And, you know, it was beautiful about back then. And you could write your own narrative. You could be whoever you wanted to be. You could be a supermodel from outer space if you wanted to be, right? Because it was basically the story you told. You were writing your own narrative. So Rabbi was everything that Larry wasn't. Larry's my real name, or Lawrence. Larry was the kid in high school that didn't have a lot of friends, you know, who was shy and insecure. And then by the time I hit high school, I get into hardcore summer of 85. I start going to shows the second half of 85, or I'm sorry, second half of 15, summer of 86. I just turned 16. I start going to shows. So I'm starting to get into this, and I'm probably in 10th grade at this time. I go away for the summer. Not away, but I just don't go to high school, right? By the time I hit my junior year in high school, everyone knows who Rabbi is. And now I become a senior, and people are lying about hanging out with me. And Rabbi became the guy who was on guest lists everywhere, backstage everywhere, knew everyone, but more importantly, they knew who I was. And Rabbi became his own identity. Rabbi was the dope smoking, cool guy that just loved everyone. I have a lot of great friends to this day. And, you know, it's funny, even when I came in here over at Love Hate, you know, I saw Jose and he's like, hey, Rabbi, what's up, man? To this day, they still call me Rabbi. And it's such a small, small group of people. But you know what? In the scene, like I saw Walter with Grill Biscuits, and that's probably the first time I've seen Walter Sugar since the mid-90s, maybe 93, 94. And he called me Rabbi. And I saw Charlie, and he called me Rabbi. And when I introduced myself to Civarelli, and I hadn't seen Civ in a long time, but they said, hey, it's Rabbi, you know. So there are people that know me as Rabbi. And I'm not someone that's at war with the past. You know, it's something I've embraced. It's cool. I think that, you know, when I think about how normal my life is today versus, hey, Green Day stayed at my house one tour. That seems like a million lifetimes away. But back then, when I look in the mirror, I only saw a rabbi. Now, when I look in the mirror, I see Lawrence. When I think of rabbi, I almost think of them as a separate person because it is so far in the back, you know, in the past, and it's so much not who the person I am today. But it's, like I said, it's something I embrace. It's something that's a part of me. And to a lot of people, that's who I am still to this day. You get to that place in life where you have to determine what you're going to do with your life. And, you know, you got to pay bills, so you got to work. And it's not so carefree anymore. And it would be great if we could all be 17 forever. But that doesn't work. It really doesn't work.
No.
You know, and the unfortunate thing is, like, when you're hanging out in that moment, you think it's going to last forever. You know, when I got into the scene was limitless. There was such a huge ceiling. You didn't see the end. And then after being there, I left when I was 25. Not really officially, but, you know, that's when I fade out, start phasing out. Am I going to continue doing shows, or am I going to – what's the next step? Where do I go from here? Because I was hitting the ceiling. And at 25 in the scene, I don't want to say things ran its course, but, you know, we all grew up with a Loser Rob or a Johnny Sponge or – people that were older that ended up passing the exit and just staying around a little too long. And we could talk about, you know, Bobby Lode, and I love Bobby, you know, but he drank himself to death because obviously he had a drinking problem. He probably had some other problems as well. But one of the things that struck me was when Lode broke up, Bobby wasn't ready for them to break up. And even though Fausto was able to do stuff and Jeff Tucci was able to do stuff after, and so was Tony, Bobby couldn't. Bobby wasn't ready for that party to end. And the truth of the matter is the party ends somewhere. And it's best to be the first to go than the last to go. Because the last to go, suddenly you become, oh, Loser Rob or Hurtin' right. Rob or you know what I mean?
Lode is one of those bands that would play Churchill's a lot. So that's
one,
that's one place we have not talked about yet, but I know you also had a hand at booking shows at Churchill's. So what are your memories of both seeing shows and booking shows for Churchill's?
Now, Churchill's was not my first venue or even my second venue. You know, like I said, I did the Thrash Can, TOSOL. I brought down Violence. I brought Sepultura down on their first tour. First U.S. tour is their second date. They played Tampa, then they played the Thrash Can, and it was Obituary, Sadist, and Cynic. Just an amazing show from start to finish. Then once the Thrash Can closed, I started doing shows at Washington Square. Now, Washington Square was a great, great venue. It was actually designed for live shows. It was just a bar, but it was like a 300 person capacity. 500 was pushing it, okay? And that is where I did a majority of my shows. So I brought the Boss Tones down to the Square. I brought Green Day to the Square, Into Another and Shift to the Square. Rancid I brought to the Square. I brought, gosh, who else? Shelter, 108. I did a Henry Rollins spoken word at the Square. I got to pick up Henry Rollins from the airport with Tim. And, you know, it's funny because they were doing the Lollapalooza tour. They just played Orlando and they had a day off. So I reached out to their agent and brought Henry Rollins down for a spoken word. So the agent asked us, hey, if you guys could pick him up from the airport, that would be great. This is pre-9/11. So you were able to walk right up to the gate. So we see Rollins coming out. He just has a duffel bag and that's it, you know? And it's like, this is Henry Rollins, okay? This is like, wow, this is like punk rock icon, you know? And he treated us like he was shocked to see us. Evidently, the agent didn't tell him someone was picking him up. He arranged for someone to pick him up. But we walked around with him, and it was cool. It was cool, but it was like strangers treating a stranger. This was 91. This was right after Joe Cole had been shot. And so much that I know about Rollins now, because, you know, listen, we didn't really have the internet back then. There was no YouTube. There was no Facebook. There was none of that. So you didn't really know the entire history of someone before meeting them. And like I said, there were some really deep things I really wish I would have known about Rollins. Because like I said, this is someone that was a real huge influence on my life as a kid coming up. So Rollins taught me how to count money. That was pretty cool. You know, backstage at the square, he taught me how to count money. And I still use that to this day. But there was just a whole lot of cash. I think the other time I mentioned I brought Fugazi down, and their entire set was spent counting money. Counting singles and $5 upstairs in the Cameo. You know, it was, I missed their set.
I know a little while back you were talking about the connections with other people as bands were making their way down, right?
Right.
Gainesville, Orlando. Were you able to bring a lot of those bands down from those same connections, or were you already established at this point to where you could basically reach out to a band or a right. member of a band and say, hey, I want to book you at Washington Square or at Churchill's? Like, were you able to have those connections at that point?
I think it was a combination of things. I think that during the square, like, for instance, Fugazi was probably the exception to this rule, because I flew up to Boston to hang out with a good friend of mine. And I mentioned him earlier, Dan. And it was Fugazi was playing the Channel on St. Patrick's Day in Boston, a 3 o'clock matinee. I knew the promoters up there, and we had a good connection. So I ended up talking to Ian and Guy about coming down. And, you know, Ian handles his own booking. That's how I got them to come down to play the Cameo. And that was my biggest show. I mean, 1,300 people showed up, at least 1,300 paid. There's probably about 1,500 there. The Believers opened up. There's a really great picture of the Believers. I'm in the background of that picture. And it's one of my favorites. It's Chad is at the forefront. And I think Tony and Dane have fallen down. And it was just a lot of fun.
Did you have your pick as to which local band you wanted to play that show? Like, how did it wind up being the
Believers? Oh, yeah, yeah. No, because I asked the Believers. And Funkhauser opened up. Funkhauser was Dennis, who eventually played with Machine. So, yeah, it's for me, Funkhauser, they had a big guitar sound, so it actually worked really well in that venue. The Believers sounded better in smaller venues because they were more up close with the crowd. The stage was really high at this point at the Cameo. You know, it's interesting because every time Rollins come through, the stage would get higher because Rollins, that was a Rollins thing. So the stage eventually got higher. Like when I saw 7 Seconds the first time at the Cameo, the stage might have been just past my knee, the top of the stage. By the time Fugazi came through, the stage was, I'm 6'4", it's probably about 7 feet, and a barrier in front of it. But getting back to the original question, I worked a lot with Margie from Leave Home. There were different agents around the country. And at this point, Quicksand was working with Lisa Miller. Lisa Miller was working with Bob Slade at this time, because at this point now, it's really Bob and I doing shows. And this is kind of how stupid things were. I don't want to use the word competitors because I never viewed it like that. But Bob surely did. You know, like once Bob called me a grifter, I was like, grifter? I got to look that word up, you know? And listen, I grew up with Fausto and Tony and Jeff and Bobby, of course. I remember when Bobby and Jeff were doing Insanity Assassin over at the Junkyard. And now he's managing them, and these are my boys, and he doesn't like me, not because I did anything wrong to him or, you know, like did anything ugly with him just because I did shows. And I don't think he understood, and maybe I didn't understand it either back then, that it was part of scene building, you know, building up the scene. And you got to keep a balance out there. You know, you don't want just one promoter because you miss out on a lot of great bands because of the relationships. Like I had stronger relationships with Margie, and that's Into Another, that Shift, that was Sensefield, that was SNFU and the Bouncing Souls. Like she also did, what was that band? Offspring. You know, she did a lot of these. I didn't have a chance to bring down Offspring, but you know what I'm saying? Your relationships with different promoters got to really expose the scene. I think I'm not sure how I brought Green Day down. I'm not sure. I know it wasn't through Margie, but I worked with different people. There's a guy, Peter Davis. He was out of the Minnesota area. He did the Melvins. He did Helmet. He did Nirvana. I had Nirvana booked tentatively. Their guarantee was $200. This was Bleach. This was not Nevermind, right? I brought the Melvins down to Washington Square. That was a great show, but only 60 people showed up. When I brought Green Day through, they were still touring in a van. I think Rancid, when I brought Rancid down, how do I say this? Green Day was the bigger band. But the size that Green Day was when I brought them down versus the size that Rancid was when I brought them down. Rancid was much more popular at that point. I wasn't really a big fan of Rancid. I didn't really connect with them. A lot of the bands I did connect with, that Rancid was one of those bands I didn't connect with.
Did you feel that was a critical component for you bringing a band down, or did it not matter as much because you knew a band could draw a crowd?
I never did it for money. I mean, Boston's like Dickie, like I really liked those dudes. You know, like all the Boston bands, Eye for an Eye, Maelstrom, Sam Black Church. For me, I was a fan first. So it wasn't a financial thing for me because I couldn't play in the big leagues, you know, doing the arena bands, right? And, you know, you start getting into the mid-90s, you got Danzig opening up for Black Sabbath at the Sunrise Musical Theater, okay? You got Red Hot Chili Peppers playing, you know, Mother's Milk came out and suddenly Red Hot is playing at Club 1235, which became Deco's. And you're talking about maybe 2,500 people. They were probably south of 2,000, but still, you know what I mean? You had Bayfront, Jane's Addiction, and the Beastie Boys and Henry Rollins. And suddenly these bands just became just huge. So I couldn't really compete with that, nor did I want to. You know, I mean, you know, for these smaller bands like Mean Season and Unbroken, I got to bring them down to Churchill's. And like I said, I was a fan first. So it was fun to see them. Like I brought SNFU and the Bouncing Souls to Churchill's. I brought 108 through with Bloodlet opening up. You know, and to me, I look at like that show right there is a show I would have wanted to see. So for me, it wasn't about, oh, I'm going to bring down this band. I'm going to make all this money. That was never, ever, ever anything I even considered. I'm glad you asked that question because I never really even thought of it until you asked that. You know what I mean? I mean, I know that there was a faction of gutter punks in the scene, and I think they thought that I was some sort of corporate bad guy. I was the man and all this stuff. And oh, punks for profit. Nothing could be further from the truth. I think I made money when I brought Fugazi down. I made money when I bought the Boston's down. Most of the time I broke even. I didn't really have any money to lose. I did have an incident with Born Against and Rorschach. Yeah, let me unpack this really quick because this is something that it was, in my opinion, it was a misunderstanding, and it was something that really got blown out of proportion by some factions. And it's something I had to deal with on a personal level throughout. So Born Against and Rorschach come through, and you know, gutter punk out of New York. So, and at this time, I'm not living at home, and I'm living on Tim Price's couch in his parents' house. Okay. And so I call them, I bring them down. I'm working with either Adam or Sam. And they tell me their guarantee is $125. Okay. So Bob Goldie's band opens up, Hangman, local band. And about 100 people show up. It's a $5 ticket. The square took $2 off the top. And that was a great deal. You know, they would get $2. So if it was a $7 door, they got $2. And I always tried to keep my tickets under $10 wherever I was. I think the most expensive show I ever did was when I brought Sick of It All down to the Kitchen Club in Coconut Grove. But with Born Against and Rorschach, after the show, they asked me for some more money. I gave them the $125, and I gave them an extra $25, so it was $150. I gave Bob Goldie's band $50, and I kept about $100, right? They didn't say anything to me at that point, but then they went around telling people that I ripped them off, that I was supposed to pay them $125 each, and that I didn't, and it was $250, and I ripped them off. And hand to heart, I'm going to tell you, if they would have told me it was $125 each, I would have addressed it if it was $125 each. Okay? They didn't say that. It was $125 for both bands. That was my understanding of it. My understanding was I gave them more money than they asked for. I don't know how they think they could have asked for. And listen, this is early 90s, okay? This isn't $125 each. That's kind of low right now, right? But for the time, for a band that was drawing 15 to 20 people when they went out and played, they weren't getting a $250 guarantee off of 15 and 20 people. They were touring off a 7-inch. Now, I would see Chuck Rorschach play. They came through. They played Churchill's a couple of years later. And I approached Chuck, and I pulled him aside, and I explained to him my perception of the situation. And he flipped out on me. He was yelling at me, and he didn't really handle himself correctly. Because listen, we're not talking about life-changing money, all right? We're not talking about life-changing money. There are a couple of bands I did wrong, Damnation AD, Wall-Eyed, and I don't want to say it wasn't my fault. I was getting under pressure by the venue on that one. If I ever see Ken Ogden from Damnation, I'm pulling out my wallet on spot and dropping him a few bills, because that was a situation that was beyond my control. And I really feel like I ripped those guys off. You know, it was the wrong venue. I should have did them at Churchill's. I did them at the church. They really dealt me wrong at the church. It was really hard to deal with those cats at the Kitchen Club. It was the Kitchen Club in Coconut Grove. So, Ken, if you ever hear this, if you see me, I got you. All right. I don't know the guys in Wall-Eyed. If you see me, call me out. I'll take care of you. Head First, a band out of Los Angeles. I gave them $100. I should have gave them a little bit more. They were on a bill with Eye for an Eye, Sam Black Church, and Maelstrom. And those three Boston dudes, they pressed me really hard for extra cash. And I wasn't bold enough, or I didn't have the courage enough to say no to them. So with those dudes, I didn't even think I gave them $100. I think I might have gave them $75, and I gave those other three bands $325 total, because I wanted to give everyone $100 pop each. So yeah, the guys from Head First, I owe some money to. But guys from Born Against and Rorschach, no, I don't. You know, I don't feel like I do. And, you know, but listen, this is all under the bridge. And like I said, it's not life-changing money. But, you know, when I brought down Rancid, they brought it up. When I brought down 411, they brought, like, Dan O'Mahony, he brought it up. Avail, those guys brought it up. And I have a lot of respect for Tim Berry, because he came back to me. Like, this is something we talked about before the show and after the show. He really thanked me and said I dealt them straight. And I really appreciated that, because that was always my intention. You know what I'm saying? Because I listen, whether I had a job when I was doing shows or I didn't have a job when I was doing shows. So listen, when I didn't have a job, I was selling weed. You know what I'm saying? So I lived in a 6-bedroom house. I had a ton of roommates. I wasn't trying to buy a Maserati. You know what I mean? I wasn't trying to pay off all my bills. This wasn't my main hustle. This was always something I did because I enjoyed doing it. It was my contribution to the scene was doing concerts. Because I knew this. If I didn't continue doing concerts in Miami, no one would. And I noticed even after I did shows, when I stopped doing shows, I started at the Thrash Can, moved to the Square. From the Square, once the Square closed down, it was to the church. No, it was between Churchill's and the church. I'm sorry, the Kitchen Club in Coconut Grove, and then it ended at Cheers. And Cheers was the very last 3 or 4 shows. It was a Veil. It was Into Another and Shift. Oh, and Sensefield. I'm sorry. I love Sensefield. I don't know if you've ever gotten Sensefield. I love those guys.
I do like
Sensefield. They're just and John Bunch, just such an amazing dude. It hurt me when he passed.
I feel like more of those bands too, kind of like Sensefield, were the bands that were playing Cheers as this shift was happening.
Right, exactly. So, and I think that was the evolution, and I think that there were certain shows, like you mentioned earlier about Bob. There were certain shows that Bob would bring down, like he'd bring down Biohazard. Even though Sick of It All were my boys, he ended up bringing them down. I got to bring them down later on. I brought down the Cro-Mags, but this was John Joseph and Mackie and the guys from Leeway, AJ from Leeway. I forget the bass player. But Tom from Smoke Dog, Tom Bowker, he was also doing shows down here. But he would bring down bands like Buzz Oven, you know? And it goes to your relationships with the different agents around the country and who you work with. And Buzz Oven's like a band I would never bring down. You know, I wasn't really into them. But All was playing a really small club over on Miami Beach. It was up on North Beach, okay? And there was this guy, Monk, who was their roadie, traveled with them. And this is with, I think Scott Reynolds was singing. So it's Descendants with Scott Reynolds. So I go up on stage. It's a really small stage. I think it's maybe a knee-high stage. I hop up on stage to go, you know, just run across and jump on the crowd. And he comes up from behind me and pushes me, like, really hard. He did this to me also. Oh, this is interesting. I used to stage dive a lot at the Cameo. And I hop up on stage. This is Agent Orange and All. This is the first time All came through. Descendants had just broken up. I go up on stage, go do a stage dive, and he comes up behind me and pushes me. And there's a barrier between the stage and the crowd. So at this point, I know most everyone, including security. Security were our boys. Like, all these guys lived in my neighborhood. I used to hang out with these guys when they weren't doing shows. So we knew security. We owned the Cameo. I got to be honest with you. We owned South Beach when we were kids. We knew all the clubs, you know, because so many of the clubs were just fronts for drugs. So we knew all the DJs, all the bartenders, all the people working the door. So we got in everywhere, whether PIL was playing Club 1235 or Social Distortion or we never paid for anything, never paid to see. I saw the Pixies at the Cameo, never paid for anything, the Ramones. But anyways, so this dude Monk pushes me for the second time. Okay. So the first time I was okay. I could have got hurt and that kind of sucked for him. But, you know, but then he does it in a really small club. And Jesse from Foix grabs him and pulls him into the crowd and he gets pummeled. Okay. And Bill Stevenson, he's a true veteran. He comes out from behind the drums. He's got his hi-hat stand in his hand. He's ready to like throw down with these guys. Like he's ready. And I had a good talk with that dude Monk after the show. And I was like, listen, you did this to me before, you did this to me again. And you don't have to do that. I don't know why you're doing it. You're trying to protect the band. I'm not going to run, you know. I'm not going to run and dive into the drum set You know, maybe that's been your experience with other folks. I'm not going to do that. And had a really good conversation with Bill Stevenson after that show, talking about, you know, because he did Black Flag Tours. And he talked about in Detroit when someone pulled a gun on Rollins. And but let me just bring it back to this though. You mentioned Churchill's earlier, and I really did want to get into Churchill's. The thing about Churchill's is it was such a great venue, but it wasn't always all ages. And there were some shows I guess I should have done at Churchill's. This is post Washington Square. But because it wasn't all ages, like a veil came through before I brought them down. And they were brought down by someone else, and they ended up having to play a warehouse. Actually, they played the Machine Warehouse with Jason Fan. And I just think that Churchill's, as the scene got older, it got a little easier to make it 18 and over. And everyone would get in anyways. But you know, Churchill's probably wasn't a place you wanted a 15 or 16-year-old to be at. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, I understand the whole church, the whole all ages thing, but 15 and 16 is really young, especially in the real world. In our world, it wasn't, but in the real world, it was. So I did a local night at Churchill's, and it was every Sunday night, and it was local bands. It was just focused on local bands. And now we're a few generations in, because my generation coming up was Cynic, Foi, The Believers, Powerhouse, Awake. These were my friends. Mentioned earlier, Amazing Grace and the Drills and Silent Rage. That was the previous generation. You had a band, Cultural Brain Rot, which CBR, they were amazing, great band. They were a Kendall band. And now quit. Powerhouse was gone at this point. Beyond Reason would evolve into Machine, which was basically the guys from Beyond Reason, Jason, Mike Mirabel, and Jose with Dennis from Funkhauser. Brian would go on and do with Adele, Timescape Zero. And now there's no Powerhouse, quits on a completely different page. Load is still out there, but Load, I've done local shows with Load as well. I've done a few gigs, but because of my relationship or lack thereof with Bob Slade, it was hard for me to really incorporate Load into what I was doing. But he was incorporating Load into what he was doing, which actually worked. You know, and I got some thoughts on both Bob Slade and Ralph Caballero. Bob was the manager for Load. Ralph Caballero, Graveyard Ralph, he was the manager for Quit. Like I said, I don't know if Bob likes me or not. I don't really care at this point. But from a very professional standpoint, I think that Bob did a much better job with a lesser band than Ralph did with Quit. I think that, and the reason why I say it, and it's not me comparing the two bands like that. I just think that style-wise, Quit was much more ear candy. They were more like Green Day and Jawbreaker. And for that time, that's a band that should have been at that level. Whereas Load was definitely more hardcore, more sluggish, more of the Melvins, more of that, you know, Steel Pulp. They were more of that grungy, hard, but not Nirvana, catchy. I thought Bobby was a great front man. I think that musically, both bands are great. But if Bob Slade would have had Quit would have been much bigger, much bigger. And they really should have been. And sometimes you hit that wall, and I think maybe that wall is kind of what caused them to really just, okay, time to grow up, right?
Was there any reason why perhaps you didn't make that transition to maybe getting into management for bands?
Well, you know what? I kind of kicked it around a little with Funkhauser and with the Believers. Thus, that's why they opened up for Fugazi. You know what? I knew that I couldn't do for them what others could have done. Like, you know, when Instead came through, I had the Believers open up. You know, when the Bostons came through, I had Funkhauser open up. So to me, it was, I was able to do that at that level, but that was all I could do, you know?
Why do you say that?
So, well, it's also this too. I just think that it's the band is built on the individuals. I think that Lode was more committed to touring. Funkhauser never would have toured. You know, those kids, they were just a bunch of local kids, and that's all they were going to be. The Believers, I don't know if they would have toured either, to be honest with you. And this is me looking back now, because I never really thought about it and unpacked it until just now. Whereas, you know, Quit tour. You know, now, how long could they stay on a tour playing small venues and not really getting national exposure? Lode was actually getting national exposure, but that band was so self-destructive that there was no way they could have continued on past their due date. So both those bands broke up for much different reasons. Powerhouse, I think Powerhouse could have taken it to the national level, but once again, I don't know. You had Dan from Cavity. So Dan could have toured and Dan would have toured. That version of Powerhouse where it was Ivan and Tim, it was, I believe, Andy, Scott, and Andy Powell, Scott Baldwin, and Danny. Now, Danny did Cavity. Cavity's amazing. Danny grew into that role. Okay? The last incarnation of Powerhouse never would have toured. Jason, Andy Powell probably would have. I don't think Tim and Ivan could have. Like Machine. Machine played the Milwaukee Metal Fest with Integrity. But that was their pinnacle. Once again, there was, they hated each other towards the end. Okay? Jose, the guitarist, great musician, he had already checked out. Mike Maribel was not serious enough. Dennis and Mike were drinking too much. Jason was an absolute crazy person at that point. Okay, he had been doing this way too long. He was an absolute crazy person. And it was just too much tension in the band. Now you take them, you stick them in a van for 6 weeks. Okay, they would have killed each other. So Jason's gone on and toured. He's toured with The Weapon. He's actually toured with Cavity, he's toured with AAA. He's done some touring. It's hard. You know, I went on the road once with the Ed Mattu Struggle, and it was Juan Montoya, it was Scott. I think Juan Montoya is the only one really in that band that really did anything beyond that band. But I did 6 weeks, though. I did 4 weeks with them, and it was rough. It's like having a bunch of girlfriends in a van. And it's like, okay, look, this is my space. If you need something over there, you ask me, I'll reach it. And hated each other. We got somewhere, we would just take off, right? I'd hang out with Kyle from Swivel Stick. I'd hang out with Kyle. Kyle was great. And the first part of that tour, we had Floor with us, which was a Steve Westbrook fan. And Steve and Juan would eventually go on to do Torch. But now we have a van. We have a trailer, so all the equipment's there. But now there's eight of us in the van. And the only escape you got is if you got to drive, right? So you had that. And then once they left the tour, now we're all stuck in the van with the equipment. It was rough, man. It was rough. And there was no way getting away. And you're stuck with these people. You wake up with them, they're there. You go to sleep with them, you're there. Right. You know, they're there. So I think that's what you need, that chemistry to take to the next level.
I know when you said this word, tension, it wasn't because you were referring to the band Tension, but they were also around
this time, too.
But they have not come up yet in our conversation. So
we're going to talk about them right now.
Did you get a chance to see Tension play or perhaps?
Yes, of course. It was the Sunday nights. And what it did was it opened up an entire, like, all these Coral Springs bands. Okay. So, Shai Hulud. It's funny. I was already as seen by Newfound Glory by the time Newfound Glory came around, but I love Chad, and you know, Chad was part of that scene, that Coral Springs scene. You had Ray with Grass Patch, Ray Sousa. Shoot, who else? Mike Hurley from Tension. They were a lot of fun. Actually, I did. I booked a tour with Tension and Timescape Zero in Florida, and it was Tampa. It was. Did we play that? We played Gaines. We played Tallahassee. We played Gainesville, and then Melbourne. It was like four dates, and it was a lot of fun. Different personalities to manage, right? Like one of the things I do now professionally is I manage personalities. So I was managing personalities back then too. And in Tallahassee, we played this. It used to be a hospital during the Civil War time. It was turned into a frat house. So that was interesting. We played Matt Sweeney's house in Gainesville. Matt's with No Idea. He was a Miami guy. He played in that band. Retired from now on. He also did End of the Century Party. But Gainesville had like so many great bands. Don's Ex-Girlfriend, Radon. Radon's one of my favorite bands in the state. Bloodlet's one of my favorite bands in the state. But once again, it becomes generational. So we leave the Quit Powerhouse generation. Now we're in the Timescape Zero Machine generation of bands, which Bloodlet's a part of. Radon's a part of that. Radon was actually a part of the Quit generation. But they kind of, you know, before it's Chocolate Grasshopper, they broke up, and then Radon got started and so forth. There were so many great, great, great Florida bands, you know? And for a lot of these bands, like Tension and Grass Patch, it was, oh, what was Mitzi's band? It was a ska band, Jive Step Bunch. It's like, it was Rich and Mitzi. And once again, it's now you got this generation of bands. And this is their first in, you know, the first version. For a lot of these, this is the first band they were playing with. Ray would go on to play with Load right at the very end. And it's interesting talking to him about how dysfunctional Load became towards the end because of the drugs. And, you know, once again, we were all very self-destructive. You know what I mean? We were all seeking self-destruction. It was rough getting through that time in life. I don't know if it was a South Florida thing. I don't know if it was a just a hardcore thing. I do know this, though, that it was a time that will never happen again. Because, like, I mentioned all the violence that we grew up with. And thankfully, when I went to go see Gorilla Biscuits, or even when I saw Sick of It All and Murphy's Law, or even Judge, when Judge came through a few years back, there was no violence. No fights, at least. And to me, it's a good thing. It really is. You know, I was going to say I had some mixed feelings about that, but, you know, the scary aspect of it is completely gone. But it's also this, too, the memories we created, the lives that were touched and changed. But getting back to bands, you know, Brethren was a great band out of Hialeah. You know, and a lot of these bands actually put out some 7-inches, were able to do some stuff. Mindframe was awesome. But I think that the band has to be wired a certain way, and timing is definitely is very essential for a band, especially to become at that next level.
Right.
To be able to move on, because, you know, it's hard keeping it together. You know, if you're living at home, it's really easy. You become an adult. Now things like, you know, making money and paying your bills becomes a problem. You know, like how many great NBA players never made it to the NBA because they had a kid when they were, you know, in college, and suddenly that NBA dream and playing overseas became so impractical, you couldn't do it. And I think that happened, and I think that still happens to a lot of aspiring musicians. It's just adulthood kicks in,
of course,
you know. But, you know, we've had some really great bands in Florida, at least during my time. I mean, there's some new bands out there, too, that I probably have no clue who they are. And I'm sure they're just as amazing, just as cool. So the individuals, you know, just the level of musicianship, the memories, because sometimes it's not even the music, it's the memories that they leave you with. You know, it's
Well, it's good that you took the time to share your memories. And what it was like through your lens. And I share this with a lot of guests. Your experience was not everyone else's experience, even though you may have lived through the same years together. So it's really important to capture that in this episode. So thank you so much, Rabbi, thank for you. Coming on the podcast. And I think we've answered the question, what happened to Rabbi? We have a pretty good idea what happened to Rabbi at this point, I would say.
I think so. I mean, you know, it's I'm still alive, which is, you know, considering some of our friends who can't quite say that. Listen, I'm in a really good place. You know, I think that after the scene, just kind of grew up, you know, I really took on, you know, sometimes life takes you in a lot of different directions. And I travel so much right now. I probably travel more than I've ever traveled before. I'm in a good place. I'm in a good place in so many different ways. And I'm not at war with my past. Some people are. I'm not. I've embraced every aspect of it because I realized this, that you don't get do-overs. You can't go back and, you know, there's some things you just can't change. You can't go back and change the past. You could apologize for things you've done wrong. You could try to make things right moving forward. But I think as you get older, that margin of error gets smaller and smaller. So, but regardless, I'm going to make sure I don't show any regrets in my life and really enjoy life and just, you know, just make the most of it. You know, like I said, life is too short. I promise you, I ain't crossed waves with nobody. I ain't got, you know, I was thinking about that when we first talked about this. I started thinking about some people and I'm like, yeah, man, I don't dislike that person. I don't like, you know, I don't have anything bad to say about them. Why? You know, they might have did me wrong at that moment and I felt it, but you know what? That's like 30 years ago. So yeah. And Jeff, listen, I really appreciate everything you're doing with the Florida Sound Archives.
Thank you.
Whatever you do, you keep on doing it, man. All right. You keep on doing it. And I think that it's really great. It's the one thing that I noticed about our scene coming up. It was never documented. There was no one out there always taking photos. So there's no real photo books out there. You know, the scene that I came up from was pre-social media, right? So there's no video. Like, we didn't have cell phones. You know, we didn't have cell cameras. So it was not only rare to have someone with a photo, you know, like a regular camera, much less a video. So much of that stuff is just kind of just lost to the winds of time.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate what you're doing with documenting Thanks. All this stuff. Keep up the good work, man.
Something that he remembers. 69.